indestructible. Cuando en el alma se siente una herida, indestructible.
A warm welcome to the first episode of Indestructible, Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. For well over a decade, I've been writing on Latin American politics, trying to cover stories which are being ignored in the mainstream media, or worse, being seriously misrepresented. Generally, Latin America does not receive serious coverage in the English-speaking corporate or state-funded media outlets. When it does, we hear a brief mention of some major drug dealer being arrested or a controversial president having had to resign. Dig deeper behind these headlines and you'll often find large webs of corruption, serious human rights abuses, massive social movements that go largely unreported, and numerous Western-backed coup d'etats in support of rather unsavory characters. Often, the mainstream media in the English-speaking world avoids linking these developments with the actions of corporations or governments that could be held accountable by their own audiences in the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, or even here in Australia, where I live. For more than a decade, Alborada has similarly engaged in producing independent journalism on Latin America for an English-speaking audience, and, more recently, one in Spanish. With a team of contributing editors, all with years of experience in Latin America, either as journalists, academics, or human rights advocates, Alborada publishes new and original content on the region while also hosting regular events, now online since the global COVID pandemic. As one of Alborada's contributing editors, I'm delighted to be host of their first regular podcast. Every month, I'll speak to authors, journalists, academics, filmmakers, human rights activists, musicians, and politicians, aiming to highlight the unseen stories coming out of Latin America. Despite centuries of colonization and neo-colonial assaults, the continent and its people refuses to submit themselves to their domestic elites or global centers of power. Seen from this perspective, Latin America and its people are perhaps indestructible, indestructible. So it gives me great pleasure to have us introduce as the podcast's first guest, Mexican film director and producer Eduardo Flores Torres, who, together with Gabriel Burstein and Roberto Chile, has directed the 2020 documentary Fidel Up Close on the life of the legendary former Cuban revolutionary leader Fidel Castro. A cinematographer with more than 20 years' commitment to the craft, Eduardo has collaborated in more than 30 feature films and documentaries. In the program notes, there's more info on Eduardo's extensive film CV. It really is impressive. In his documentary Fidel Up Close, an intimate portrait of Fidel Castro, Eduardo obtained an unprecedented amount of access into the former Cuban leader's personal life. Coming from a wealthy family from the northeast Holguín province in Cuba, Castro graduated in law from the University of Havana, where he became involved in Cuban politics, which many Cubans saw as being completely subservient to corporate interests of the United States. After launching a failed attack on the Moncada barracks in 1953, Castro and his younger brother Raúl were imprisoned for more than a year until they were granted an amnesty in 1955 by the US-backed dictator Fulgencio Batista. Eventually, after meeting Ernesto Che Guevara in Mexico City, Castro returned to Cuba with 82 men on board a small boat, which was barely seaworthy. After less than 3 years of guerrilla warfare, Batista was overthrown on the 1st of January, 1959. Now, many of you may have heard something about Cuba, its political system, or its leader, Fidel Castro. But before I move on to my interview with Eduardo, I want to read to you two quotes I think merit attention. The first comes from a book by Keith Bolender, which was published in 2019 by Pluto Press and is titled Manufacturing the Enemy, the Media War Against Cuba. In it, Bolender writes that the mainstream US media, quote, developed its Cuba posture in obedience to Washington's designation of the revolution as illegitimate. Once the ruling elites came out in bipartisan voice declaring Fidel Castro an enemy, the press went about slanting its coverage in conformity with foreign policy objectives. Destabilization, subversion, and economic warfare have been the tools of regime policy used by the US government. The media has willingly helped forge them. There was no effort to examine the revolution as a popular expression of true Cuban nationalism. The only explanation provided was one that alleged Fidel Castro was a master manipulator who had duped the Cuban people down the path of anti-Americanism and, then worse, communism. Consequently, politicians and the media refused to understand the historical roots for revolution, as they could not admit it was the United States' hegemony over Cuba that formed much of its basis. The dictator Batista might have been the lightning rod, but the storm against neocolonialism had been brewing long before. Fidel Castro was the tempest that swept it all away. The next quote comes from the US State Department, who in 1991 published a series of internal documents covering US policy towards Cuba from 1958 to 1960. One document states, "The majority of Cubans support Castro. The only foreseeable means of alienating internal support is through disenchantment and disaffection based on economic dissatisfaction and hardship. Every possible means should be undertaken promptly to weaken the economic life of Cuba. A line of action which, while as adroit and inconspicuous as possible, makes the greatest inroads in denying money and supplies to Cuba, to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government." End quote. With a brief interruption under the Obama administration, I think this statement alone could broadly summarize Washington's aggression towards Cuba from 1959 until the present date. So, without further ado, the first episode of Indestructible and my discussion with Mexican film director and producer Eduardo Flores Torres. Let's
bounce ideas back and forth. If there's anything you want to ask, elaborate on, by all means.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Okay, so Eduardo, first of all, I think that you and your fellow directors and producers, entire team, has made an absolutely fascinating and wonderful documentary. I've seen a lot of documentaries and films and read many books on Fidel Castro, but I have to congratulate you for a lot of original footage and providing, I think, for the first time, many in-depth interviews with people that were quite close to Fidel. And as we know, for security reasons, Fidel was his personal life was quite guarded. So my first question is, why this film and why Fidel Castro and the leader of the Cuban Revolution?
Well, the whole Cuban experience is a landmark for Latin American politics and for the life of Latin America. Us in Mexico, we've seen the whole process evolved with a lot of interest from the very beginning, besides the fact that Cuban history and Mexican history are very linked together. Some of the most important events in Cuban history somehow happened or started in Mexico, and some of the most important events in Mexico somehow passed through Cuba as well. So there's a very strong link and a very strong sense of brotherhood between the Cuban and Mexican people. Within my actual family itself, there's no difference. I grew in a very political family that was very into the whole Cuban process from the very beginning. So I learned and I've heard through long meetings at home and after meal conversations what was happening and what happened in Cuba ever since I was a very young age. And then as time went by and I kind of knew quite a bit about the whole Cuban thing being in Mexico, I started going to Cuba probably when I was about 15 or 16, basically for tourism. And then I was a film student, so I was going to the film festival every year. And then I became a cameraman, a lighting cameraman. And Cuba was a very popular shooting destination for Mexico. So anyway, one way or the other, I was attracted to Cuba for many times and for many years. And then this opportunity came up. And I also, just like yourself, I've seen many, many documentaries about Fidel and about the revolution and read many, a lot of stuff about it. But I always felt that there was a lack of an approach to a more personal, more intimate angle of Fidel's life. Fidel, I believe, and I still believe, is been a titanic figure and such a landmark persona in all the history of contemporary Latin America, especially Latin America after the Second World War. And what this long-time struggle between Cuba and the United States has meant for Cuba, for Cubans, and for everyone else. So when this opportunity came up, we kind of engaged it with a lot of interest to try to show the people what more than a biography, what was the thinking and the actions of a man such as Fidel. So that's why we chose certain very specific events, and through interviews and archive material, we kind of approached the character to see how he reacted, how he learned about it, how what was his attitude towards this. These cases, mm-hmm. and that's how the fame came up to be.
Interesting. You interview Peter Cornball, or Peter Cornball is interviewed in the film. He's from the National Security Archive at George Washington University, and he states, and I quote, "The United States abuses of Cuba before the revolution were so significant, even John F. Kennedy admitted privately that the United States had committed grave sins in Cuba and would have to pay for those sins. In fact, was paying for those sins through the advent of the Castro leftist revolution." For an audience that is not familiar with Cuba pre the 1959 revolution, what was Kennedy referring to?
Well, the things that going back in history a little bit, Cuba didn't actually gain independence from Spain like most of the countries in Latin America did. When the Cubans were fighting for their independence, the Americans intervened at the very late of the century before, in 1898, and they intervened in the war to make it in their angle. So the Cubans basically came from being a Spanish colony to being somehow an American colony. So it was because of American intervention that the Cubans gained independence in that moment. I mean, it's very clear that even without the Americans stepping in, the Cubans would have gained their independence probably a little bit later. But it happened then. So the link between Cuba and the United States became very, very tight right after that. So as the 20th century began, Cuban life was completely dependent on America. And indeed, as Peter says, Kennedy said, there were lots of abuses there. Cuba was treated pretty much like a colony, okay, with a huge abyss between the haves and the no-haves, the rich and the poor, the non-education. There was a big crime ring run in Cuba and in Havana, running casinos and stuff like that, that was drawing mainly American servicemen to Cuba. So this created a very, very atypical situation in Cuba where the Cubans weren't actually leading the future of the country. Since all the main decisions in Cuba were taken by the Americans, Cubans really had little to do with that. And that's what really sparked the revolution. I mean, before the actual Fidel's phase of the revolution, there was a lot of turmoil in Cuba, and there was a lot of dissatisfaction on Cuba because they, like everyone else in the world, they wanted to gain their own independence, proper independence, and lead their proper future on their country. So that's what Kennedy said. He, as we know, when Kennedy finally got to the White House, he wasn't really, really aware of much of the international aspects of American foreign policy. And one of the ones that he came to learn as he stepped into the Oval Office was what was happening in Cuba and what were American plans in Cuba. Because since the actual revolution happened right before Kennedy came in, it happened at the last moments of the Eisenhower administration, and all the politics that were drawn from the U.S. towards Cuba were part of the Eisenhower. Basically, Kennedy just inherited all of that. And I can clearly understand his reaction when he learned what was happening, and he learned a bit more history of the U.S. involved in the Caribbean. He said that. He said exactly what Peter said.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned at the beginning, I've certainly seen a lot of interviews and documentaries on Fidel Castro. But what was your access like in Cuba to making this film? Were all the people you approached willing to talk openly? What was that process like?
Well, I must say that we have no restrictions at all. Mm-hmm. We were given free access to pretty much everyone we wanted to interview. But we did came forward with the project to the actual Castro family. And we approached them and he said, hey, listen, we want to do this film. I think there is a gap between the knowledge and understanding of contemporary Cuba that has to do more with Fidel persona, not Fidel the politician, Fidel the comandante, Fidel the head of state, but the persona itself. And we brought it forward, and it happened. This was like 1 year before Fidel's passing. And although he was already very elderly, he was still in full control of everything that was happening. And the whole family was engaged. At that very moment, they were engaged in a debate on whether to open up a little bit of Fidel's personal life or keep it closed as it had been and only show the world what the head of state was. And when we came with a project, they decided to go this way and to take this angle. And that's why I think the film is so important, because it's the first time many aspects of his life are actually spoken about. In fact, many of the photographs, the still photographs that are shown on the film, is the first time ever that they're shown, because those photographs came directly from the family albums. Mm-hmm. They were given to us just to scan and then give back. And there are moments in Fidel's life that have not been seen before by anyone but the family. So we were given a lot of access. There was a lot of warmth from the Castro family and from the Cuban authorities, mm-hmm. and a lot of help for us to do the film. So we basically work all together, because putting together such a vast amount of archive material is not easy. Mm-hmm. And accessing so many people.
Mm-hmm. And Castro himself was, as you said, he was still alive, so he knew about this project. He actually agreed to. Okay.
He knew about it very well. He agreed to it. Mm-hmm. And we were told later that right before his passing, on the very last few days of his life, he actually asked his soon-to-be widow to look into this project and to make sure that it happened, that we wouldn't bounce into any bureaucratic wall that mm-hmm. would prevent the film from being done. So we have that help and that access, mm-hmm. thanks to his encouragement and his involvement in the film. Obviously, we weren't able and we didn't want to interview him because he was very, very ill at the end. But he's shown on the film on some of the different stages of his life that it's pretty much as if we had been with him.
And of course, he was always such a reserved man in terms of his private life. He guarded his personal life intensely. And of course, as we know, for some very clear security reasons. I'll ask you about that a little bit later on, but I'm interested in you, the diplomat Vicky J. Huddleston, the chief of the United States Interest Section in Havana from 1999 to 2002, appears in the film. Now, while she appears reserved in her comments about Fidel, like other ex-US diplomats, she projects a sense of admiration for her political foe. What do you think diplomats like Huddleston learned from dealing with Fidel Castro over the years?
Well, first I must say that it must not be any easy. It mustn't be easy at all to be a foreign diplomat, especially from the United States, posted in Cuba, because like all the lights are on you all the time. She happens to be a wonderful lady. She doesn't talk about her time in Cuba with any bitterness or anything. She talks so warmly about Fidel himself and about her experience. I mean, she had to guard the U.S. interests in Cuba and to make sure that the embargo was enforced. So that must be a terrible job, because you're basically the most evil person in the island, because you represent all of that. But when I approached her and she agreed to be interviewed, and when I finally met her, I was expecting to come across someone that was very strong and very, you know, very hard-hearted towards Cuba and what the Americans have to do. And what I found was this very lovely lady who had an amazing time in Cuba, who's a lover of Latin America altogether, and especially of Cuba and Cuban culture, and that she had a wonderful time. And she talks of her experiences with a lot of humor. She actually talks of her first meeting with Fidel.
Yes.
And how he approached her and made her embarrassed in front of the whole diplomatic corps that was gathered in that event. And she talks about it with such warmth and with such humor that you really have to like her. And yeah, she spent there she was there 3 years, which must have been pretty, really tough. And soon afterwards, she retired from the diplomatic service, but she's still very, very there, very well informed. And she's got very clear ideas. And she's one of so many people that I've spoken to that's completely in favor of an easing of the hate and an easing of the relations, and to have the Cubans from both sides of the Strait of Florida to come closer together, because such a conflict like this only makes harm to the United States in the view the United States have on the world, on the leadership of the United States. So doing this doesn't do good to anyone. Mm-hmm. She is, as you can imagine, she's also very critical of the Trump administration and the Trump's way of leading with foreign affairs, just on a local and domestic political angle. And that's all he cares for, as she says, which I agree. Mm-hmm. So interviewing her was wonderful. It was a great, great experience, a great conversation. In fact, after we turned the cameras off, we stayed speaking for another couple of hours. That's how well we got along. Yeah,
I've read several accounts where even hardened Republicans that went to Cuba and actually met with Castro would eventually sort of begin to take a different perspective towards Cuba, Fidel, the revolution, et cetera, et cetera. Cuba's Minister of Culture, Bel Prieto, and former advisor to ex-president Raul Castro also appears in the film. And he claims that Fidel Castro once said to him, and again, I quote, "The best anecdote for consumerism against the idea that happiness means possessing material things was to cultivate the spirit, the arts, music, reading." Now, what we know about Castro was that because of security reasons, he often stayed in various apartments and houses in Cuba. But on closer inspection, he actually did not live an ostentatious life. Now, obviously, other than wanting material comforts, which most people take for granted in the developed world, do you think most Cubans embraced Castro's philosophy regarding consumerism and an appreciation for culture?
Now, I think, yes, I think in a way, Cubans in general are very aware of the weight and the strength and the importance of culture in every aspect. And it's quite outstanding to see how Cubans outstand in so many aspects of cultural life, in literature, in music, even in science, in education in general, in medicine. I mean, which is culture and science are propelled in Cuba from very early age. And for such a small island with around 10 million people, it's really outstanding how many Cubans have come out of Cuba and into the world, been really phenomenal in any of these aspects. I think the revolution from the very beginning undertook the major mission to propel the science and culture in Cuba. And that's very clear, as so many personalities we can see there. I think Fidel led a very aesthetic life. I don't think it was ostentatious at all. I mean, I know propaganda coming out of the Cuban Americans in Florida have tried to portray that. And when I actually got closer and closer to the family, I really wanted to see whether this was true, whether it was true that he was very aesthetic and very leading a very simple and very humble life, or whether it was the opposite, whether he was actually one of this, you know, this kind of king that had everything from himself while his people were starving. And what I found and what I came across, it was just the opposite. He really led a humble life. He dressed in his green, olive green dressing, and that's how his life was, really. He obviously had lots of books and lots of things that concern culture in general. But his was not an ostentatious life at all, mm-hmm. at all. Very atypical from the typical Latin American dictator that leads that type of life.
Correct. Now, your film covers Fidel Castro's relationship with the country's artists and intellectuals. In it, they talk about him in a positive manner and how he strongly supported the arts. Castro's critics, of course, would point out that the leader did at times clash with Cuban and Latin American intellectuals, and would point to the cases of Norberto Fuentes, Herberto Padilla, and the Chilean writer Jorge Edwards. Could you comment on Fidel Castro's relationship with Cuba's artists and intellectuals, both at their high and low points?
Yeah, I think in a political situation like Cuba, I mean, at the end, it was a very strong monolithical state that ran all aspects of life, and it had a very firm control on everything, in culture, including the intellectual development of the island. And that it's easy to understand that there were many dissidents, intellectual dissidents, people that will not fall within the sphere of what was being led, what was being built as the Cuban intellectual thinking post-revolution. And like in every country, I mean, I think that's the role of the intellectuals everywhere, is to question the status quo and to lead and to try to open new ways. So it's no surprise to me at all that in Cuba there were those cases. I mean, they were very... they sounded very big. Mainly, I think, because everyone was taking an eye into what was happening in the relationship between the Castros and the intellectuals. And every time a case came up of someone that did not agree or wanted to lead a different path, that case was magnified. But I think that's the role of the intellectuals, is basically to question and to open new ways of thinking. Of course, the relationship he had with all of them, it wasn't always completely nice and easy. There were clashes, of course, but that's the way it goes when you're talking about free thinking anywhere in the world. And every time I quote free thinking, a lot of people look at me with a funny face and say, well, what do you mean free thinking? There's no free thinking in Cuba. But, I mean... Then I question and then I ask, what is free thinking then? Is there free thinking in America, for example? Mm-hmm. Where is free thinking? If we look at things that way, we probably find ourselves that there is no true thinking anywhere. Mm-hmm. But the intellectual life in Cuba has developed a lot and has basically impacted many, many other countries in the world. That's why you in Australia and me here in Mexico, we're talking about this. There are very few other Latin American countries where we could be talking and quoting specific names of intellectuals other than Cuba's.
Yes. And I think it should be noted as well that the clashes that occurred with certain intellectuals in Cuba occurred in the 1960s during the sort of the height of the Cold War, and many of those authors were actually published again in Cuba. So it's a complex situation, as you pointed
Very
out.
Very complex, yeah.
Certainly. Now, Castro's children appear regularly in your film. They talk about their father's warmth and how he would relate to them. Fidelito, Castro's first son, also appears in the film, but as is public knowledge, a few years ago, after suffering from serious depression, he took his own life. Could you tell us more about Fidel Castro's children and what you learnt about them?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, what happened to Fidelito was very tragic. In fact, he took his own life quite soon after I interviewed him. We spent a couple of days because he asked for a pre-interview just for us to meet and to talk about things. And I guess he was trying to get a sense of what my angle to the film was. And we ended up spending two wonderful afternoons talking about politics and talking about Cuba, but mainly talking about life. And he came across as a very down-to-earth person, very, you know, humble guy. He was aware not only of being Fidel's son, being named just as his father, and his physical resemblance was so similar to his father. I mean, that must have been quite an adventure. But he was aware of that. But he, my experience, he never took that as a, you know, as a pinpoint to emphasize anything. He was a scientific. He was knowledgeable in nuclear science. He majored in the Soviet Union and then came to Cuba to lead the nuclear agency. He was a scientist, not a politician. It was very sad to learn that he had taken his own life after battling depression for many years, something that I only learned later. The other sons, well, my intention of interviewing some of the other siblings was to show that Fidel was also a father, just a father like could be you or could be myself. Mm. One of them says about the relationship, he says, people think that my father was the commandante at home, and he wasn't. He was just my father. He would play with us when he could. He was very warm, but he was also very strict, just like every father is when you're trying, you know, to upbring your children and to choose them and to teach them the best and the best way to go in life, just like any one of us would do. So my intention there was to show that the person was just normal person like everyone else's. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes very across because all of the kids, that they convey on that idea. They say it wasn't like always easy. Well, we try to lead a normal life like any other Cubans.
My understanding is that Raul Castro's daughter is perhaps the only one of the two Castro brothers' children who has taken more of a prominent public role in Cuban political life, and mm-hmm. and she also appears in the documentary and makes several interesting comments. So,
yeah, she's a wonderful lady.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if I can move on to the next question. In the 1970s, Fidel Castro gave the U.S. journalist Barbara Walters an interview. In it, she said, let me be specific, and I quote, let me be specific. Your newspapers, radio, television, motion pictures are under state control. No dissent or opposition is allowed in the public media. Fidel Castro replied, and I quote, Barbara, we do not have your same conceptions. Our conceptions of freedom of the press is not yours. And I say this very honestly. I have nothing to hide. If you ask us if a paper could appear here against socialism, I could honestly say, no, it cannot appear. It would not be allowed by the party, the government, or the people. In that sense, we do not have the freedom of the press that you possess in the US. End quote. Now, I have my own views regarding the Cuban government's position towards the media, but I'm wondering what you make from such an exchange between Walters and Castro's own words.
Yeah, I mean, Castro had exchanges, many different exchanges with American and foreign Western journalists. And pretty much all of them came back to the same thing, to the same question. It is indeed a different type of understanding free media and free press. My understanding of this is that such tightness on the control is a consequence of the harassment from the outside. Cuba was forced to close up and to be very tight inside in order to defend itself. As you surely know, right after the revolution, the attack from the outside was so huge that the only way for the revolution to survive was to close up and to make one single fence to repel everything that was coming from the outside. So I would say that such tight totalitarian state is a consequence of the harassment from the outside. I'm pretty sure that had the revolution not been harassed in such a way, it wouldn't have taken that way or that angle to defend itself and to prevent the counter-revolution from taking on and bringing down the Castro revolution from power and taking on the island again and bringing it back to something similar to what it was prior to 1959. So basically, most of what happens, most of the tenure that the revolution took towards the inside of Cuba is a consequence of the harassment from the outside.
Yes.
I have no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I often tell people that are interested in Latin America and this subject that, of course, the Latin American media do not call left-wing or progressive presidents bad names. They collaborate and openly call for their violent overthrow. So that's something that I think you and I would have a similar perspective on. Now, I enjoyed the way your film covered Cuba's involvement in African politics, the reception Fidel Castro received in South Africa's parliament when he visited the country in the 1990s was certainly impressive. Why do you think Fidel Castro and the Cuban leadership became involved in African politics from the 1960s onwards, and of course heavily involved up until the 1980s?
Well, I think the Cuban leadership was drawn into the African conflicts of independence. That, as it happens, most of them took place at the end of the 50s, at the early 60s. So the life of many of these countries runs from the beginning with the same timing as the Cuban Revolution. So the Cubans were drawn into those conflicts, into those struggles for independence, as a matter of solidarity. A lot of people would say that that the Cubans were looking for a hotspot, somewhere to shine, somewhere to show their might and their force, which they actually did. They were involved in Ethiopia, they were involved in the Congo, and most noteworthy, they were involved in the struggle on Angola. Angola was about to become independent right after the Portuguese dictatorship collapsed. But then right after that, because Angola was in such an important geographical position, pretty much every other country intervened and prevented the independence to happen. And a huge civil war took place in Angola. The Cubans' intervention there was very important, not only for the future of Angola, that prevented the a South African supported regime to be installed in Angola, that was also supported by the US, but also helped bring independence to Namibia and in a way pushed for the liberation of Mandela and the soon-to-be first elections in South Africa and the election of Mandela as a president. So I believe Cuba's intervention there was very important for the future of many of those countries. And if you think about it, there were no other... the Russians and the Americans were involved in many of the conflicts. But basically, the struggle in Africa was very difficult. So all those countries were battling not only their own problems, but also being a little chess match in the big East and West battle that was the Cold War.
Okay. It's my understanding that during almost five decades only one of Fidel Castro's personal bodyguards defected to the United States. The man's name was Juan Reynaldo Sanchez. According to the ex-head of Cuba's intelligence organization, the Dirección General de Inteligencia, the DGI, Fabián Escalante, who is interviewed in the film, some 634 assassination plots or attempts were recorded against the Cuban leader. In your film, you also interview several of Castro's former bodyguards. What did you find most interesting about them?
Well, there was a constant, and that's very well documented. There was a constant effort to bring down not only the revolution, to bring an end to Castro's life from the very beginning. And that's been so well documented that it's pretty comic to see how efforts financed and led by the CIA were trying one after the other, and they failed one after the other. And not only because of the tremendous effort of his personal security, his personal security detail, but also because of the Cuban people. I mean, he's, as the film says, Fidel Castro's main bodyguard was the people and the people guarding him. And when you start studying how these assassination attempts came to be and how they fail, you'll find that in most cases were the actual people that found out or heard something or knew of something and sparked the suspicions of his security detail to prevent or to stop that assassination attempt. A lot of people have gone to jail in Cuba and in other countries for trying to assassinate Castro. And the words of some of his bodyguards are really warm, as they say how they were prepared to give their own lives as they were in charge of the security of Fidel. And that, I think that's a very interesting aspect of the film, how all the people that were in charge of Fidel's security in a way became part of his own family, because they spent day in and day out together, they would travel together, they will experience most things together. So it was a very tight relationship, and that comes across when you interview the people.
Mm-hmm. And I think we also have to remember that, of course, Fidel Castro was a guerrilla leader before he became the head of state of Cuba. So that enormous or Herculean effort that he engaged in actually overthrowing a US-backed dictator must have created an enormous, or did create an enormous following and an immense loyalty towards him. So Absolutely. It was, yeah. And I think that's interesting that that's portrayed by the security detail that is interviewed in your film. Your film documents some of the terrorist attacks against the island by the historic Cuban opposition in Miami, Florida. You have the case of the bombing of the Cuban airline flight 455, which was bombed in 1976 in mid-flight and saw 76 civilian passengers killed. Figures like the known and convicted terrorist Orlando Botch and Luis Posada Carriles are also covered in the documentary. Did you or the other producers of your film try to reach out to members of the Cuban exile community and question them regarding some of their past actions?
Well, we thought about a lot about that a lot, but then that would have been another film. The fact that we show that terrorist attack for the airliner in 1976, more than actually showing the attack, what we wanted to show was what was Fidel's reaction to that. Because remember, we were trying to show the persona, how he would react to such landmark events. So we weren't trying to show the dark and the white, or the contrast, or show one testimony and then contrast it with another testimony from the other side. Films like that, there are hundreds of films like that. What we wanted to show was Fidel's reaction, And that's what we did on that chapter. We showed a lot of how he reacted to the actual event, how he led the protest of the people, and how he delivered that tremendous speech on the Plaza of the Revolution Square that was absolutely packed with people, and how he led the mourning of the Cubans towards the death on that flight. That's what we wanted to show, and I think we did. We had to give a bit of context of what had happened for people to understand that Cuba was actually under tremendous pressure from the forces coming from Florida and sponsored by the U.S. And the Americans did not do any effort to hide their efforts to bring down the revolution. I mean, they were supporting and financing these tremendous acts. It's very hilarious. It's very ironic that the U.S. is such an terrorism-sponsored state. And they condemned other states from being terrorism sponsors. It's very ironic. It's very hypocritical. But it's perfectly documented how all of these efforts and all of these deaths, because 76 people died on that flight, but more than 2,000 have died in terrorist attack towards the island throughout the years. More than 2,000, about 2,500 more or less, which is very close to the figure of the death of the World Trade Center. If
correct.
You think about it.
Yes, yes. It's a significant figure, and these are attacks
that took
place during several decades. So,
it's a lot.
Yes.
It's a lot. Give me 1 second.
Certainly.
I had lost my power plug, and then I have to running out of battery.
That's okay.
There you go. Okay.
Fantastic. Eduardo, my final question, without providing any spoilers to your film, we know that Fidel Castro passed away in Havana, an old man at the age of 90 in 2016. How do you think future generations of Cubans, and I will say also Latin Americans, will remember him and his political legacy?
I think time is shedding light into the true Fidel. Fidel was first and foremost a nationalistic Cuban. He wanted and he cared for the best for Cubans from the very beginning. And I don't think there's any doubt about that. And the way he led Cuban's revolution and then Cuba after the revolution until today, and how he faced this tremendous foe, which is being at odds with the U.S. just 90 miles from your coast. It's a tremendous effort. And having survived and having outlived 10 U.S. presidents and still hold on to his principles, I think that's such an outstanding career. Leadership like that will probably not be seen again. I mean, times have changed. We can see today that leaders lead their countries on Twitter or, you know, on social media. That type of leadership and what it required, it's probably gone forever, not only from Fidel, but from people of that type, of that tenure. Times have changed and leadership is carried out in a different way now. Castro, I think, is going to be recorded in history for many things, mainly for having brought a small island on the Caribbean, less than 10 million inhabitants, into a leader on the world stage. And this is actually mentioned in the film by Peter, who was a tremendous and wonderful contributor to the film. Cuba became a world, a runner, a player on the world stage on every aspect, on diplomacy, on sports, on everything. Cuba is now known everywhere, and that's mainly because of the efforts of the people of a country, very small country, but only in 50 years. Because prior to this, Cuba was unknown. No one outside of the region, probably a lot of people didn't even know Cuba existed. And I was a lead player, and I think that's an outstanding achievement, and that's something that's going to be recorded in history forever.
Fantastic. Eduardo Flores Torres is a director of the one of the directors of the film Fidel up close, an intimate portrait of Fidel Castro, together with Gabriel Burstein and Roberto Chile. Eduardo, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and I wish you the best with all of your future work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rodrigo. It's been a pleasure. I hope we have the chance to talk again. And there are more projects coming and there are more things happening, and we should keep in touch.
Certainly. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rodrigo.
Okay.
All the best.
Thank you.
That was the first episode for Indestructible. Once again, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to launch this podcast, and would encourage our listeners to support Indestructible on Patreon. Many thanks in particular go to the producer of the program, Pablo Navarrete. I would encourage our listeners to send feedback. You will find our email address on the website, and I would certainly encourage you to send us feedback and let us know what you thought of the first program. Next month, we will return with another episode. So until then, goodbye and stay safe. Indestructible.